This is the Al Lewis Show, and I'm Al. How you doing? I got a fantastic show for you today. Yes, the tax man cometh. This is the end of the fiscal year 2005 for a lot of us, and we're starting to expect our W-2s in the mail in a few weeks. We'll be getting those in, and we'll either be wanting to get back some of what they've already taken, or minimize what more we have to give, or we could follow the law. What is that law? Well, my guest coming up on my show in a few short minutes is going to have a lot of interesting information for you about the tax law. He wrote an amazing book called Cracking the Code, the Fascinating Truth About Taxation in America. And so far, people who've read his books, he's trying to keep a track. I've taken back well over $642,000 back from the government. So this is some really heavy-duty information that not everyone knows about, and so we're going to go ahead and give him a jingle in just a sec. So I'm going to see what other... Here's a song by the Nashville Session Players called Taxes. We'll see what their take is on it, and in the meantime, I'll just get him on the phone. So here we go.
Song of taxes, working class cancer sore. He in Boston Harbor and Revolutionary War of giving to the rich and taking from the poor. Sing a song of taxes, let's even up the score. Sing a song of taxes in the presidential pew. Throw in grease, senators, and corrupt congressmen in the brew. Add a depraved governor, the Education Regency Board, a few greedy city council members, and Attila the Hun's great horde. Let's all tax the trucker for driving down the road, and tax the company janitor for cleaning the commode. Put a levy on the mechanic for changing auto oil. Don't forget the tired farmer for turning up the soil. Tax the college student for learning how to think, and tax the hotel maid for scrubbing out the sink. Don't overlook the waitress for serving up the food, and tax the exotic lady for dancing in the nude. Let's tax the faithful mother for bringing up her son, and tax our country's children for chewing bubble gum. Put a tax on entertainment, cigarettes, and the liquor store. Raise sales tax, shift the burden to the homeless and the poor. Sing a song of taxes, fight illegal wars for oil, slash aid for the veterans, big out on the corporate spoil. Privatize Social Security, fill the purse of the Wall Street whore. Reduce firefighters, police, and the planet's health just ignore. Build some Mimex missiles and a B-51 or two. Ring the world with laser weapons, paint them all red, white, and blue. Print up some cardboard money, who cares if we all go broke? Who'll notice it's our fault when the planet goes up in smoke? Supply-side neo-con men with a $1 trillion rip-off scam. Give the poor a half a cup of water and the rich Grand Coulee Dam. Borrow from our children's future on the backs of the working class. Buy the wealthy a few more yachts while the rest take it in the ass. Tax us up every orifice, keep giving us the screw. And next time the vote comes round, find out what the people can do. Run your pork fat butts out of office, put your family on the welfare line. You'll be in some federal hole, bottoms up doing hard rock time. Sing a song of taxes at the U.S. National Bank. Open up the vaults, clean out the septic tank. Cry out from the gutter, beat on your garbage can. There's a God in heaven up above, save us all from the tax man. Sing a song of taxes, working class cancer sore. Tea in Boston Harbor and Revolutionary War. Of giving to the rich and taking from the poor. We're all mad as hell and we ain't gonna take no more.
Let me just fade this thing out right here and fade you up.
And on the line we have Peter Hendrickson. Hi, Peter.
Hey, Alan. How you doing?
Good. Thanks for joining me on my show.
My pleasure.
All right. Let me just see if I can get my thing so I don't sound so terrible. All right. I sound better now. Okay. Welcome. I'm still in awe of the book, and maybe I won't be in awe for much longer once I actually put it into practice.
There you go.
but I'm a little nervous. You know, I read your book, in April of last year, and I had already sent in my my paperwork, mm-hmm. and so I didn't want to do the back taxes thing. I thought I'd just wait a year and get brave, but this year I'm gung-ho. I got my printout of my 4852 form, and Anyway, but we'll get to that. I want to talk to you a little bit about your book and about what's up with the truth about taxation. And so maybe we could start by just saying, how did you come about the information that you write in your book, and how did you research your book, and what's going on with the history of it?
Well, the information in the book is essentially what the content of the law. That includes the statutes at large going back to the original enactment of the income tax in 1862 and proceeding up through the formation of the codes, which are merely representations of those statutes. There have been a few statutes enacted subsequent to the initial 1939 code, and in fact there are occasional enactments every few years. Those enactments constitute statutes at large themselves. They also are incorporated into the current code. So while the vast bulk of what we know of as the income tax code or the Internal Revenue Code, currently in the 1986 version, reflects laws passed in the latter part of the 19th century and throughout the early part of the 20th century, there are a few portions that are more modern than those periods.
Okay.
As far as the research is concerned, a lot of it is a matter of, you know, pouring through musty old pieces of paper in law libraries, but happily also a good deal of it is done digitally on a computer, thanks to the fact that much of this information, much of the statutes, and certainly the code itself are all digitized at this point. In fact, I make them available on a CD, and they're easily searched and investigated. So, So it's a combination of, you know, a little bit of shoe leather and a lot of key punches.
Cool. Well, the gist is of the book is basically a matter of word definitions. It seems to me like
definitions are key. They certainly are an important element of the way the law is. You know, law is two things. There are two key elements to law. One is context, and one is definitions.
Okay.
And context establishes, in broad terms, the things and people and territories to which a law applies. Definitions refine the application of that law within that context, and it's unrecognized by many people who haven't had occasion to study the subject, but definitions in the law are often wildly different from the definitions of homonyms of those legally defined terms that we're accustomed to use in everyday language. The tax code or the tax law, the revenue law, incorporates a number of those, amongst them wages, employee, employer, trader, business. Income itself, in fact, is a term that has a meaning in the context of revenue law that is completely different from the meaning that we ascribe to that, to the word of a similar sound that we're accustomed to use in everyday speech. In everyday speech, we use income to refer to all that comes in,
right,
just receipts in general. In the tax law, it's a much, much more narrowly defined concept, one referring to put it explicitly, the benefit of the exercise of federal privilege or federal prerogative measured by the dollars produced in that exercise. It's a little bit further defined as well to be the profitable benefit of the exercise of federal prerogatives measured by dollars.
Federal prerogatives. What is that?
The federal government is what I will refer to as a corporate entity, and I say that a little reluctantly because there are people who have a tendency to kind of view that as a pejorative concept, the idea of the government as a corporation. But it really is, it's corporeal in the broad sense of the term. It is a corporealization of the polity. In other words, it's a It is a formal entity that has a legal existence, a real legal existence, allowing it to sue and be sued and to act and be acted upon. And this is a good thing. It's not some kind of a nefarious Illuminati scheme. Mm-hmm. It is a good thing. If it weren't a corporeal entity in that legal sense, we would have no way of gaining redress from it. If it were to harm us in some fashion, there wouldn't be anything to sue. As it is, it has a real existence in a legal sense. Mm-hmm. And as a consequence of that, it also has rights. It has ownership rights. It has property rights. And it is able to do the things, exercise the powers that we assigned to it, the powers that we delegated to it when we created it as a people. And those constitute its prerogatives.
Okay.
So when we created this government, as in the case of when we created the state government, we gave up some of our own power, some of our own claims to these governmental units, and in part this was to provide them with substance so that they could do the things we wanted them to do, and also it was to provide them with means of raising revenue, means of financing their behavior. In a lot of ways, you can think of the creation of a government and the assignment of authority in this regard as a family that, you know, has a kid grow up to a responsible age, and then they take a portion of the family farm and they give it to that kid and
right.
say, this is yours now. Here's where you can raise your food. Here's where you can here's some property from which you can earn a living.
Okay.
And we did the same thing with our governments. We give them certain territorial ownership rights. We give them certain legal ownerships, and they're able to use those to finance their activities. In the case of the federal government, it has a series of prerogatives. It has certain authorities. It has the ability to run a post office, for instance. It has the ability to control the items crossing our national borders. It has authorities to maintain a court system. And it has the ability to charge fees and impose taxes associated with all of these things. It has the power of eminent domain, and it has the power to create profit opportunities because of that the exercise of that power. Being involved in doing these things profitably constitutes activity that the government, federal government, has a legitimate claim to a part of, and it exercises that claim by the way of excise taxes. Excise means a piece of the action.
Okay.
And the federal government is entitled to claim a piece of the action of any profitable endeavor that involves its own property, just much as in the
sure.
case of if your neighbor sets up a lemonade stand in your driveway, you can legitimately claim
okay.
a chunk of the profit.
Right.
Or he can set it up on his own property.
Okay.
Those are his choices. But if he's going to do it on yours, if he decides that you've got the better curb appeal, you've got the better spot for that lemonade stand, he's got to work with you. He's got to be willing to kick 5, 10, 15% your way to let this happen.
Okay.
The federal government is exactly the same. If you see an opportunity to do something involving its powers or its property,
I see. Right.
It's entitled to grab a piece of the action.
Sure.
And it does by way of excise taxes.
And that's an indirect tax.
Excise tax is an indirect tax.
Right.
That's right. It's a tax that is imposed on a voluntary activity and essentially on the exercise of a privilege of some sort.
And but the Constitution forbids any direct tax. Correct.
The Constitution forbids a direct tax unless it's apportioned on the part
okay.
of the federal government only, by the way. Important distinction.
Oh, okay.
The state governments are not subject to that limitation. But the federal government, the Constitution says in two places, the only thing that's in the Constitution in two places, it says that direct taxes can only be imposed by way of apportionment. Apportionment means that the government can establish a tax, it can impose a tax on a thing, and when it has done so and has totaled up the whatever that adds up to, it then applies the tax, it divides the tax among the states based on their proportion of the national population. So that, for instance, if the federal government were to impose a tax on windows, say it put a $10 tax on windows, and we had 100 windows in the country.
Okay.
So we have $1,000 total. The $1,000 would be divided up among the states based on their portion of the national population.
Okay.
With, you know, Maryland, or a better example, Wyoming, you know, owing $10, and, you know, Michigan owing $100 maybe.
Okay.
Or New York owing, or California owing $100.
Sure.
And all the gradations in between. And that amount would be due from the states, by the way. It would not be due from the citizens.
Okay.
It's the states that pay a portion of direct taxes.
Okay.
Now, they would raise it from their citizens one way or another, and how they did so would be up to them.
Okay.
But that's the only kind of direct taxation that the federal government is entitled to impose.
So then how do we have this thing called the income tax? Well,
the income tax is an excise tax.
Oh.
It's a tax on a privilege. It's a tax on a voluntary activity,
uh-huh.
which is to say, the activity of exercising a federal prerogative. Nobody is forced to do that. No one has to or can be forced to engage in using a federal power to make profit.
I see.
So that tax passes muster.
Okay.
So it doesn't need to be apportioned because
right.
it's not a direct tax.
I understand. So when you get your 1040 and you're looking at your W-2s and everything and you're saying, okay, in the little box 1A it says these are your wages. When that says wages there, what do they mean by wages?
Well, wages is a defined term in the law. There are two definitions
okay.
for wages. But in both cases they refer to the remuneration paid to a federal worker, either a worker directly for the federal government or for a federal instrumentality or agency, or the officer of a federal corporation.
Okay.
Wages in the federal revenue law do not mean earnings. They don't mean pay for labor.
Okay.
They mean explicitly remuneration paid to a federal worker or office holder or the officer of a federal corporation.
Okay, so I don't work for the federal government in any way.
Good for you.
Yeah. So when I look at that, that number must be wrong. Like the on the W-2 that I get from my employer, that's an incorrect number.
You have an employer?
Well, I have someone who I labor for, and they give me.
There's a company you work for.
There's a company I work for, and they give me. They give me money for that labor.
Right. Yeah, I very much encourage right. people to
alter language.
Break the habit of using the term wages, employee,
uh-huh.
employer, what
okay.
have you, when referring to themselves, unless they really mean it the way the revenue law defines it, because it becomes very difficult to keep
right. Okay.
Engage in a meaningful dialogue when you're. You know, when those
Thank
things
you.
Are coming up. So.
All right. I'll try to keep that in mind in our conversation tonight.
So you work for a company.
Right.
And they issue an information return, an affidavit,
right.
which is what a W-2 is, claiming to have paid you wages in a given amount, by means of which they are attesting to two things. After the W-2s are executed under penalties of perjury, and they're attesting to two things. They're attesting to an amount, a dollar figure,
uh-huh.
they're also attesting to the legal character of that amount. They're not just saying we paid Alan or whoever X number of dollars. They're also saying that those dollars constituted income as that term is meant in the revenue law.
I see. Okay. So there's two things they're saying with that W-2.
Two things, that's correct.
Okay. So I get that in the mail and I go, well, okay. So since I've read your book and I've looked in at the real law there that says wages mean payment from
these limited things.
Yeah, these payment from the federal government or these types of things. Then I go, well, so that's not true, but I still feel like I want to be clear about we should follow the law in submitting a 1040. Or whatever you know.
Well, a 1040 has a couple of different purposes.
Okay.
And yes, certainly to the degree that that anyone is required under the law to furnish one, they certainly ought to do that.
Okay.
Among the purposes, the two fundamental purposes to a 1040. One is to respond to allegations of the payment of income to the filer.
Okay.
Such as in the example that we're talking about, the W-2 that you were referring to. Somebody is alleging the payment of income, and we'll consider that income to have quote marks around it because it is income in the legal sense of the term, not income in the common word sense of the term. So they're saying that a payment was made in a given amount with the legal character of a tax of reflecting a taxable activity, reflecting engaging in a taxable activity. That's the meaning of the legal portion of that. So one of those purposes for that 1040 is to respond to that. The response can take basically three forms. It can take the form of acknowledgement, which is to say, yes, this is what is being alleged here is true. I endorse it. I agree with it. I'm going to record those figures in the appropriate places on the form where it asks me how much income I was paid and go move on from there, do the calculations and so on and so forth.
Right.
Follow the procedures. That's one of the response mechanisms. Another one would be to modify that allegation if it was true to some degree and untrue to some degree.
Uh-huh.
And the third would be to rebut it outright if it was entirely incorrect.
Okay.
In any case, the 1040 is the same form for those purposes.
Okay.
And then the other category of purpose for a 1040 is to claim refund of taxes erroneously or incorrectly withheld or collected.
All right. Okay, so in your research, you have found a way to rebut this these claims successfully?
If those claims are incorrect?
Right.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, unsurprisingly, the government itself produces forms, just as it produces forms for acknowledging these various things, it also produces forms for rebutting or correcting erroneous information on an information return, such as a W-2.
Right.
Or a 1099, both of which are categories of what are known as information returns for the sake of the of those listening that may not be familiar with this. An information return is different from a 1040-style return in that an information return is not a declaration of liability. It's not a self-assessment form. It's just a form by which information about a payment is transmitted both to the government and to the individual about whom, with whom the return is concerned, in order to give them notice that testimony about them has been furnished to the government so that they can respond accordingly.
Oh.
So,
okay. So let me just use myself as an example because I'm going to be doing this in a few weeks. I'm pretty clear that I haven't had any kind of remuneration from any kind of profits from the federal government, and so I get these what I consider erroneous statements from my from the person who I work for, the company that I work for. They say that states that I made X amount in quote wages. How do I then repair that information and take and is there a way for me to get back the money that's already been withheld from me?
Well, as I just said, there is a form. The government produces a form. Specifically, it produces a form to address erroneous W-2s. That's a form number 4852.
Okay.
Again, that form is explicitly for the purpose of correcting.
Okay.
Erroneous W-2s and also erroneous 1099-Rs.
Okay.
The title of that form is Substitute for Form W-2 Wage and Tax Statement or Form 1099-R, Distributions from Pensions, Annuities, Retirement, or Profit Sharing Plans, IRAs, Insurance Contracts, etc. So that's the form intended for that purpose.
All right. So would I have this Form 4852, and it says enter wages, compensations, and taxes withheld. And then A, da-da-da-da-da, goes through the thing. So I would then fill this out according to how I see it to be truthful statements. Would I submit this alone, this form alone, or would I submit it along with...
That form is intended to go with a 1040.
A 1040, okay. It's to be attached to 1040, okay.
In fact, it says so right on the
right,
title of the form.
It says right on the top. Okay, so I would fill out this plus a 1040. So it would be my correction to the W-2s that I received from the person who I work for. Okay. I just need to get clear. maybe I'm just being selfish, but I know I'm going to be going through this myself, and I want to. And maybe my audience might get courageous and do this too. Okay.
Yeah. This is, of course, discussed in fairly considerable detail in Cracking the Code: Fascinating Truth About Taxation in America.
And I read it months ago, and I've been sort of looking at it again just in the past couple
of
days. But
sure.
I'd like to talk a little bit about what the Internal Revenue Service, what kind of responses one might expect when you do this. I know one of their favorite words is frivolous, and that's part of their arguments that against you and other people who point out what they're...
That is one of their favorite words, although the most common response of people who file on the basis of what they learn from Cracking the Code, if it's done properly and correctly and accurately, the typical response is simply receiving a check for everything that they're claiming as a refund, which would typically be every penny that had been withheld from them, including Social Security, Medicare, etc. It is true that a few people encounter kind of speed bump behavior from taxing agencies. Obviously, it's kind of counter to the taxing agency's mission statement to be, you know, giving money back. Their mission is to bring in every penny of revenue that they can, by hook or by crook, and they strive hard to achieve that mission, even if it means fudging the facts a little bit, and even if it means making efforts to discourage people who learn the truth about the matter and discover that they really didn't need to have been handing over or allowing to be kept some 30% to 40% of their earnings every year over their lifetimes. So yes, they will occasionally try to thwart a filing, and sometimes frivolous is part of the effort. And this actually goes to another misunderstanding of definitional elements.
Okay.
The word frivolous is used, I think, because it has a connotation to suggest silly.
Right.
As though, you know, what you've done is silly. Uh-huh. What you've done is...
has no merit. Or...
ridiculous and meaningless.
Right.
And we don't have to pay attention to it.
Right.
But the fact of the matter is, frivolous is also a defined term in the Internal Revenue Law.
Oh, is it?
Frivolous has a very explicit definition. It refers to a type of return which is self-contradictory in nature.
Huh.
It isn't a type of return that is contradicted by, or theoretically or potentially contradicted by, external evidence or external elements, things not on the return itself. It is only a return that is self-contradictory. In other words, a return that makes a claim mathematically, which isn't supported by the data that is included with the return, or a return that makes a claim that is contradicted specifically by something that is included with the return. Those are the two components that constitute a frivolous return. So it is common to see that word used, but it is rare to see it used correctly.
I see. Okay.
And in fact, the IRS in particular, it varies a little bit amongst the states as to how explicit this is or how it's formulated, but the IRS is actually instructed by the law to issue the refunds when they are properly made.
Oh, okay.
Or when the claim is properly made. It really has no choice about the matter. It doesn't have the latitude to decide that it's going to disallow them or decide that that in some way or another it can delay them or hinder them. It is the law says that the government shall issue the refund.
Okay.
However, there's a little bit of a quirky element with the frivolous concept, and that is this. If a return actually were frivolous, the IRS has the power to treat it as unfiled at all, and therefore they're not under an obligation to incorporate its evidence into the record in the first place. And so the claim and the rebuttal of the allegation on the information return that's being addressed by 4852, for instance, you know, that type of a situation, doesn't ever show up in the record if that return is handled that way.
Uh-huh.
And so it is a favored position to declare a return to be frivolous and not process it, not enter it into the record, and then kind of ignore it, ignore the claim. So that response does happen occasionally. It is not a response that has any hope of longevity, because in fact the return was made and the legal obligations of the system, the legal obligations on the government, are established at that point. But it is a discouraging and delaying tactic that provides a pretext for sometimes pretty lengthy delays, and sometimes obliging people to jump through a few hoops.
So I noticed in your I received your newsletter that you sent on the internet, the email, and you said that this year they haven't returned your refund yet.
True.
So
true.
You're still waiting.
I'm still waiting for 2004. Yeah, okay. It took about 7 months for me to receive my check for 2003.
Uh-huh.
And so while this current situation, we're now looking at about 9 months at this point, maybe slightly longer than 9 months. According to the service, my return is still under review.
Uh-huh.
But we are well past the point at which my ability to sue has arisen, and that very possibly will be the next step in this process.
Oh. Now, the community of folks that have read your book and have acted on your book, you refer to them as warriors,
absolutely. They are warriors on behalf of the law.
And I'm kind of wondering what kind of you say generally they just there's a check that gets cut and they get
the vast majority of the cases. That's
right.
Exactly right.
So, but on those that they get some kind of speed bump letter or something like that or some kind of long delay on a refund, or I mean, is there what I guess I just have a question about the efficacy, you know, how effective this is in real terms. What your returns have been, what the success rate has been, and what kind of legal
the vast majority of readers simply receive their money back.
Okay.
The vast majority.
All right.
The place where some variance occurs mostly involves people who have some kind of clutter or baggage from past years.
I see.
That is in play, and those situations provide some pretexts for the tax agencies to stretch a little further in their delaying tactics and so forth. But people making clean, unencumbered, straight up, correct filings are being treated lawfully for the most part.
Okay. Which brings me to another question I have I was talking to a friend earlier this year about taxation, and he was telling me his woes of wage garnership, garnering, or I don't know how you say the word.
Garnishing,
thank you. Yes, they're garnishing his wages. And I was wondering, so I actually gave him a copy of your book, and I don't know if he's read it, but
well,
now he can't whine to me anymore. About his problems, because I like, well, I've done the best I can do. But
yes.
I'm kind of curious
what recourse someone who's already been through a very difficult audit and a very uncomfortable, like, garnishing, and, you know, when you're still in it, they're every paycheck they're taking a bunch of your money, and so it's like, what? How does one sort of alleviate all that past baggage with IRS?
Okay, it depends,
right.
And that is exactly the kind of case that I was referring to of people who have stuff hanging in the past, either because they had not filed for years, they filed you know, shift style zero returns while still you know, clipping the information, the W-2 information returns right on the thing, and
right.
And so, you know, producing a self-contradictory return, or, you know, any of several other possible complicating elements. Here are some basic principles. If the evidence on which an ongoing circumstance is based changes, the circumstance or the consequences of that situation have to change also.
Oh, I get
it. In other words, if someone is being subjected to some collection activity based on the state of the evidence in the record 3 years ago, and the evidence in the record changes,
right,
then those activities, the basis for those activities also changes.
Oh, okay.
Now, that said, there is also some procedural realities that have to be taken into consideration as well. And those are that there's, you can't go back forever and count on responsive, or count on proper responses to changes like that. Sometimes when enough time has gone by, sometimes when enough things have happened, either signatures have been put onto documents or statutes of limitations have expired or what have you, sometimes it becomes too late to effectively go back and change that reality.
Okay.
And that's just the way this is.
Right.
So, and there actually are fairly few situations where that's going to be true, or at least where it's going to be hard and fast. The further back the thing is, the more complicated it is, the stickier a situation it is as far as making changes is concerned. But there are going to be a few that are going to be written in stone, others that are going to be simply, you know, written in concrete that's still hardening, and, you know, some are going to be in a real thicket that's going to be tough to wade through and see through. But